My castaway this week is a comic actor. A patriotic Scot and a committed socialist, he grew up in a middle-class Glasgow family. He went to a public school, which he didn't like, and then to art school, which he did. He first became noticed in the early 80s as one of the new breed of comic performers whose anarchic humour characterised television programmes such as The Comic Strip, The Young Ones and Saturday Night Live. But it wasn't until the BBC series Tutti Frutti in 1987 that he achieved fame in his own right. Although these days he has to be tempted away from his beloved Scotland, his reputation is now international. One of his most recent films, Nuns on the Run, has played successfully on both sides of the Atlantic. He is, of course, Robbie Coltrane. I was very careful there, Robbie, to describe you as a comic actor, not as a comedian. You make a very strong differentiation between the two, don't you?
Well, it's not really because of any sort of snobbery or because I think being a comic actor is any better a craft than being a comedian, but I just think that being a comedian is such a different thing, really. A comedian really is somebody who stands up alone on the stage and offers the world his sensibility, which is an enormously brave thing to do. And I get up on the stage and hide behind sensibilities that are usually written by other people. And I think, you know, it's a fair distinction.
But then you've got people like Lenny Henry and John Sessions.
Yes.
And Ben Elton, I suppose. They are people who have stand-up acts,
yes,
but who also act.
Well, they came from different roots. They came from stand-up roots and cabaret and became actors, whereas I started off as an actor and degenerated into comedian.
So you not like doing a stand-up routine? I mean, do you have one?
I tried on occasions with various degrees of disaster, as you might say. But it's never really appealed to me. I think it's a fiercely brave thing to do.
Do you suffer when you work? I read somewhere that your sister said, because she knows you so well, obviously, that she could see the anguish behind the mask as
I
you
get,
work.
Well, I get very nervous. I think all performers do get very, very nervous before they perform. You have these terrible sort of nightmares about what might happen, and of course anything could happen.
Well, not if you've got a script and you know what you're doing, you've rehearsed.
Well, it's the know what you're doing bit that's the problem. There's always the possibility you're going to completely forget what you're doing. It does happen. I mean, it happened to Olivier, for goodness sake, so it can happen to the rest of us.
So, to business, what's the first record you'll play on your desert island?
The first one is Sheep May Safely Graze. This is the piano arrangement, and my mum, who's a pianist, used to play it when I was wee, and I can remember crawling around under the old Bestein and that wonderful noise. Most people don't realise that you actually get the best noise out of a grand piano if you lie underneath it. Most people have to wait till they're about 25 and the worse for wear at New Year to discover this. I was lucky enough to discover it when I was quite wee, and this is a piece that my mum used to play a lot.
Part of Bach's Sheep May Safely Graze from Cantata No. 208, played by John Ogden and Brenda Lucas, and a reminder for Robbie Coltrane of his Glasgow childhood. Was your mother a professional pianist?
Yes, she was a professional musician, but she sort of gave it up to have us lot, really.
What did your dad do?
He was a doctor, he was a GP.
And it was
a police surgeon.
Very conventional middle-class Glasgow family, as I understand.
Sort of, yes. Certainly my dad wasn't a conventional guy. I think he could have been an end-of-the-pier comic if he'd wanted to be.
So is that where you get it from?
I suspect so. My mother's also very funny in a more sort of dry, sort of Chick Murray kind of way.
So, were you always funny? How can you answer this? But did you crease them up as a child? Are you known as the family joker?
I'm afraid so, yes. Certainly my sister Annie will tell you that. I don't remember being funny. You don't remember that sort of thing about being young. I mean, I remember laughing tremendously. I can always remember the treat was to be able to stay up to listen to Hancock on the radio. I always loved listening to comedy. And Bilko, of course, came over the Atlantic when I was a boy.
And it was a close family, was it? You had brothers and sisters?
Two sisters, yes. One of whom is no longer with us. Jane died when she was 21. But my older sister is still about, I'm glad to say.
And what did your parents expect of you then, this chap who made everybody laugh? What did they think you were going to do with yourself?
I don't know, really. I suppose they expected me to do something respectable, like be a lawyer or something like that.
But did you concentrate at school, or were you always kind of
I was the boy who was always looking out the window, I'm afraid. Except for drama and art and music. I loved it. I played the trumpet at school in the orchestra. A fine exhibitionist instrument, of course.
But you went to a very smart school. Your parents
very posh.
Spent a lot of money.
Eton of the North, it was. Oh. Very nice.
Called what?
Glenarmond. It was started as a school for the sons of the Episcopalian Church in Scotland. So we'd no Scottish history at all. We were in a little sort of bubble of Englishness in the middle of the Highlands. It was very, very peculiar.
But it didn't
and
do
we
much
all talk
for you.
Like that, of course.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yes, everyone. If you didn't talk like that, you were in big trouble. And then, of course, I left there and went to art school. Everybody talked like that. We swindled right up there, you know.
So what did you do? They were at the age of 18 in, 1968, fresh out of Glenarmond.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you determined to go in life? How did you imagine
yourself? Well, I sort of wanted to go to drama school, but I had this kind of, I suppose, old-fashioned Glasgow macho idea that drama school would be full of Jessies in tights, and I wasn't far wrong. No, art school in the 60s really was the centre of all sorts of energy, not just painting. A lot of bands and comedians and ne'er-do-wells of every description hung around art school, so naturally I was attracted.
Record number two.
Record number two, Louis Armstrong. This is the Hot Five or the Hot Seven, I'm not sure which, but I remember I heard him first when I was about 13, I think, and it was the first time I'd ever heard anybody improvising. Everything before that had been written down, and there was a lot of really terrible pop music about it. The Rolling Stones were the only people I liked, and subsequently discovered, of course, they were playing black music, but I was very young and didn't know that. And I heard Armstrong playing and just thought it was just, I can remember the feeling of first listening to somebody improvising and thinking it was just magic.
Armstrong and When You're Smiling. Louis Armstrong, who was a hero of my castaway, Robbie Coltrane. Who else was a hero, Robbie?
Well, Louis, musically, obviously. Orson Welles, I suppose, is one of my all-time heroes. I just liked everything he did, really.
Didn't a film critic once compare you to him? Made your day,
yes,
not your
very,
life?
It was Pauline Kael, no less. God bless her. That was her last review for the New Yorker. She just gave up. I think, really, she meant the size and the voice. But, you know, you could do a lot worse.
She was reviewing Perfectly Normal.
That's right, yeah.
And Marlon Brando was a hero, wasn't he?
Yeah, still is, really. I mean, I remember seeing a double bill of The Wild One and On the Waterfront and thinking acting need not necessarily be a daft Jesse thing to do. He always had that great sort of warrior poet sort of quality about him. You know, he had that kind of sensitivity, which of course attracts you when you're in adolescence. You think, yes, he understands what it is to be young and confused, but if you got Adeline, he'd smack you one, you know, which for me is the perfect combination.
So the ambition, obviously, to perform was there when you were at Glasgow Art School. You did review and that kind of thing.
Review and did some comedy stuff, did some Thurber when I was there, which I enjoyed.
But when did you actually make the kind of the big leap into deciding that you could charge people to
Well, that is the leap. That's the that's the quantum leap when, you know, when you demand people, expect people to put their coat on and come out and sit down and listen. I suppose in the sort of mid-70s, really, I joined a company, the San Quentin Theatre Workshop, who had started in the San Quentin prison. Very naughty boys indeed. And I think my sister fixed it up. They were looking for somebody who could play an American heavy. And English actors usually have terrible trouble playing Americans and doing the accent. So I think I was doing my Marlon Brando impersonation in a bar. And this fella said, how would you like to do that for 6 nights a week and get paid for it? And I thought, aye, that'll do be. So it wasn't really planned at all.
What happened then to the workshop? Because you ended up, nevertheless, on the dole, didn't you?
I did. Well, Rick Clutcher, who ran it, went off to work with Sam Beckett in Paris, which I would have dearly loved to do, but, you know, my French is not so good. So I sort of footed about in Edinburgh for quite a lot of time. I rebuilt old motor cars. I had a wee company buying and selling vintage pre-war British cars. I did a lot of voiceovers. And then I went to work at the Travis and did John Byrne's Slab Boys, and that was really my first break insofar as... everything that was done at the Travis in the 70s got a lot of critical attention because it was one of the centres of British drama, certainly new British drama.
But you were on the dole quite a bit as well.
I was on the dole. I was that soldier. Yes, I worked in building sites and I've done most horrible jobs, worked down sewers and going through the motions, as they say. It's all good life experience, though.
Is this when you became politically aware? Again, every time one reads about you, there's the phrase attached.
Well, they do that, but I mean, it's not that I'm a sort of obsessively political animal, although I've been accused of it. It's really just that most people in the public eye, and actors in particular, seem determined to come across as the most bland person you ever met at an interview and never take on anything that might be noted as controversial. And I've always just answered honestly when they asked me that sort of question.
So do you use your views in your work when you're writing?
Well, all Picasso said that all art is propaganda for the self, so obviously your political views get involved in that as well.
Record number 3.
Oh, yes, the Harry Lime theme.
Theme written and played by Anton Karas. So let's get back into your career. As we were saying, that the 70s were hard work, but not particularly professionally successful.
Not rewarding, no.
Not quite. But it was really in the 80s, the beginning of the 80s, that you entered into that clutch of kind of anarchic comedians from Rick Mayall and Rowan Atkinson and Nigel Planer. And
well, I first met Rick on a show called 81 Take 2, which is a review of 1981, which was... Colin Gilbert, who has subsequently become the godfather of comedy, certainly in Scotland, and he was working on Not 9 O'Clock News at the time. And he's one of those people who has a completely encyclopedic knowledge and memory of comedy, of course, with Jimmy Gilbert, his dad, and so on. And I think he saw me in Slab Boys or something like that and decided, could I do telly? And I enjoyed it immensely. I thought, oh, yes.
But what you don't... didn't, don't have in common with all of those people is age. You're a lot older than all of them.
Yes, I'm the grand old man of alternative comedy.
I mean, they're what? They're now round about 30?
They're all in their sort of early 30s, yes, my early 40s. So I sort of started late, really. I really should have concentrated harder when I was young, as they say in the school reports. But
you're also obviously bigger than all of them. Do you think your size had much to do at that stage with your being cast?
Well, I wasn't as big then as I am now, it has to be said. I don't know. People do try and cast you because of your size, but I mean, Tutti Frutti, for example, I mean, that was a romantic lead. You wouldn't have associated it with a...
No, your size was irrelevant then.
Irrelevant. Well, it's as relevant or irrelevant as you want it to be. I mean, I was offered a lot of fat man parts, and when I first came to London, I was offered a lot of parts. We'll get the big Glasgow bloke to do the beating up, you know, and I was too proud to take that sort of work.
But my real question is, isn't your size limiting in your profession?
It is, probably, yes. I mean, what I should do is lose £100 and play James Bond. Maybe I'll do that this year.
Does it worry you, your weight?
I'll see if I can get the voice going properly. Much money, Penny.
Does it worry you, your weight?
Well, I lost close out of 3 stones last year. I'll lose about 5 this year, I think.
But in the meantime, you put it back on again, do you?
No, I haven't. I haven't put it back on, you cheeky bism, you. I'll have that coffee back, thank you.
But is there a part that you really covet that you know can never be yours?
Well, I'm too big to get into a racing car. That's about the only size thing that's really deeply upset me. I was privileged, I mean, totally privileged, to be allowed to sit in a 250F Maserati the other day, Fangio's own. And I couldn't get into it, and I thought, oh, God, this is terrible. And that was the first time, because I would dearly love a crack at one of those.
So it's another 2 stone off this year.
Each leg, you kind girl.
Slip behind the wheel. We shall talk about your motoring in a minute, but let's have another record. What is it?
The next one is young Charles Parker, who's another... He was another fellow who I heard... I sort of progressed from Louis Armstrong to Charlie Parker. Of course, most of Charlie Parker's great works were only about 10 years old when I heard this. This is from his days in the village, giving it loudly on Coco.
Charlie Parker and Coco. So let's talk about the motoring. You've got 8 vintage cars in a cowshed, is that right? Out back.
I wish they were all vintage. They're mainly old bangers, really. I've a couple of old Cadillacs that I picked up from my travels in the States. When I was young, I used to have a fantasy about opening a shed door and finding a Bugatti with flat tires and an old wifey saying, oh, just take it away. that's of every boy's dream, really. But every time you take a carburetor apart or a gearbox or whatever it is, there's usually about 100 years' history of thought in that. All the problems are the same, but they're solved in completely different ways. French cars have a completely different way of looking at the world than German cars do. German cars are wonderfully functional, but 90% ugly. British cars are terribly stalwart, but they like to look like a sitting room. Like British cars always have walnut veneers. No one in the world puts in walnut veneers but the British, because it has to look like a sitting room, you see. Italian cars are usually tin boxes, wonderfully engineered, and they rust in 5 years because they want another one with bigger fins. And you can see all the national characteristics of them. And really, it is a physical replica of the history of ideas, in the way that books are, or philosophy, or anything else.
Is that how you relax? You kind of take them to pieces and put them together again? And...
Well, my girlfriend reckons I don't really relax at all. She says that she thinks I relax by doing something different. And I think that's the old Calvinist in me. I'm not one for sitting in my bot for long.
So you're a practical man, good with your hands.
Good with me hands.
No problems for you making the shelter or catching
the fish? No, I quite look forward to that. It's a bit of a challenge.
But what about the survival of the other kind, of the spirit and of the intellect? I mean, are you any good on your own?
Well, I spend quite a lot of time in my own, working and reading and, learning scripts and so on. But my idea of the perfect day is to spend most of it on my own, but in the certain knowledge that I'll be, that Tracelle will be home at 7.
Yeah.
But I wonder,
Stripped of that?
Stripped of that, I don't know. I think I'll be okay, actually.
Could make yourself laugh.
I could make myself laugh. Some say that's the only person I can make laugh.
Next one.
Tell myself terrible jokes. Yes, I love this. I just love this. The moment I heard this, I fell in love with this, and it's sort of become a second national anthem in Scotland. The Proclaimers. I don't know if it's called Letter from America. I think it is. Certainly, that's one of the main words.
Where you go, will you stay?
Proclaimers singing Letter from America, bringing a tear to Robbie Coltrane's eye, I can see.
Well, sort of. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful tune. I mean, quite irresistible as a sort of anthem of any sort, but also the words, it's really about what's happened to Scotland since the clearances, about it, because every Glaswegian's got an Auntie Mary in Chicago and an Uncle Jim in Tallahassee, because so many of them had to leave because of the clearances, and then all the factories that have closed, which I mentioned, Lough Arbour and so on, in the words, and it gives me a picture of all these old wifeys with their entire belongings and a big tartan shawl climbing on a steamer. And I'm glad to say that it seems to have slowed down a bit. There's more people going back to Scotland, and more people in Scotland do feel they can make a go of things. I have, yes.
And you kind of quit on London, really, and gone back where you came.
Some say I was asked to leave soon. well, not really. I always wanted to live in Scotland, but I had to wait until, everybody knew my name, as they say in the old song.
Tell me about preparing for a film role. How much preparation do you do for it? I mean, you made a film that came out last year, The Pope Must Die, and there you were playing Pope Dave the First.
Yes.
How much research goes into that, or do you just do it off the cuff, as you
Well,
think?
No, you can't really do it off the cuff, because you have to, there are so many people to be offended, and usually for small details. So far better to get the details right and offend people properly than to...
Show that you put a bit of evidence.
Well, yeah.
So how do you research to become a pope?
Well, not to become a
pope. I've never asked that question before.
Well, actually, I said to somebody the other day, they said, was it not cold in Yugoslavia? And I said, it was, but the pope's outfit is a very warm one. And I said it quite seriously, too, if I was being very flash. The Pope thing, he really had to get the Pope wrong, so I didn't bother looking at the Pope. But he was a priest, so I did have a good look at priests.
How good a look?
And, well, I was in Italy for a couple of weeks, and they have an enviable life, apart from the celibacy, which I certainly couldn't cope with, because they're part of the community, and they know, quite reminded me of my dad in a way, because he When you're a doctor, you look after somebody from, you know, childhood to the grave, assuming you outlive them, and you see people born and die, and they have a distinct place in the community. They can say hello and how are you to anybody in the community, and they're welcome at every table. So I thought, not a bad life.
But you must have cut a very strange figure, hanging around the Vatican staring at priests.
Not really, because they were everywhere. I drove my old TR2 over there, so that gave it a bit of interest, and... It was the end of the holiday season, and it was wonderful.
So, I mean, to that extent, acting is a craft, obviously. It's something that you study and you research and you try and get absolutely correct and neat and tidy. But then where does the creative bit come in then? Do you just sort of hope that there's inspiration in the moment of performance?
Well, that's it, and it's what Emma Thompson calls not getting found out. The hard work is really working out all the possibilities. In my early days, you'd walk onto the film set and you knew your words and stuff, and then on take three, you'd suddenly think, oh, God, what I should be doing is blah-de-blah-de-blah. And by that time, it's too late. So it's the difference between competence and, you know, a wee bit of the old bizarre, the old magic. Because if you're still struggling with the words, or you're worried about if you're in the right place, or are you blocking somebody's light, or are you in focus or out of frame, then there's no room for the magic. Then you just get the mechanics. And of course, sounds a bit pretentious, doesn't it? But it's the truth.
You're obviously the kind of actor who gets on very well with the cameraman.
Yes, I do. I pester them like that. But it stood me in good stead, because I directed this year, and I knew what was going on. I didn't have to say, pass me that black thing with the funny shiny front. You know, I was able to say, I think it's a 40. And quite convincingly, no one laughed, I'm glad to say.
You weren't found out.
I wasn't found out.
Record number 6.
Oh, yes. Forey's Requiem. It's a wonderful piece of work. Funnily enough, Peter Richardson picked it for The Pope Must Die, some of the scenes of The Pope Must Die. And he said, do you know Forey's Requiem? And I said, it's in my blood. It's a curious mixture of music, because on the one hand, it is very holy, because it's all about the transition when you die between being a human being and being a spirit. But it's also very sexy, it's very sensuous. And apparently they banned it in English churches for a long time, which is a good recommendation for anything, I would say.
Part of the Sanctus from Forey's Requiem, Opus 48, sung by the Edinburgh Festival Chorus with soprano Sheila Armstrong and baritone Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, with the Paris Orchestra conducted by Daniel Barenboim.
Quite a turnout that afternoon, wasn't it? It was a terrific recording.
You got a lot of stick during last year for advertising Persil washing up liquid, and feature writers accused you of betraying your left-wing credentials or doing it for the money.
Well, I did it for the money, obviously.
Well, quite. I mean, what's your defence for behaving so outrageously?
Well, you know, every time you work for ITV, you work for, you know, the money is gathered by advertising. And I've been offered enormous sums to advertise dodgy organisations and people who I, you know, have no great sympathy with, and you know, advertisements that try and
sell people lifestyles that they'll never have, and there are a lot of advertisements that make children want to buy things they don't need and so on. And I thought it was quite an innocent idea. I mean, everybody washes the dishes, everybody uses washing out liquid, and
you were a man.
And Presley is very good. Well, exactly. It wasn't. There was no sort of sexual stereotypes.
And what about with the lady in your life, Rona?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be funny. You can just relax, can you? Or does she expect a laugh?
Well, she's very funny, and she is extremely funny, in fact. And she keeps me on my toes, and I keep her on her toes. There's a fair amount of competition, which I think is very healthy in a relationship.
But is it a strain when you go out? I mean, people expect you to be funny, don't they? They expect you to churn out the jokes.
Well, I don't know that they do. I mean, there's a sort of person who expects it, but they're the sort of person who, when they're not giving you a hard time, are giving everyone else in the pub a hard time. I think the public's intelligence tends to be very underrated the whole time. I mean, you get guys hanging off building sites saying, "How are you doing, Big Rab?" And it's all usually very good-natured. But, I mean, I don't go to pubs anymore because towards closing time, there's always somebody who wants to have a go at you and so on. And, I mean, really, it's about the dissatisfactions they have of their own life, but that doesn't help if you're trying to have a quiet pint.
But it takes courage, surely, to be known as a funny man, to stand up the corner at a party and, you know, be boring. Really.
Be boring. Well, it's the courage to be ordinary, as they say. And it's come to me late in life. I used to feel quite heavily obliged to sort of show off terribly at dinner parties and things, but not actually, funnily, since, you know, I've made a living out of it. Curiously enough, that kind of needs dissipated. And I think you'll find that with most people.
So now people can invite you to dinner safe in the knowledge you'll be deeply boring.
That big boring chap who's going to tell us about the hubcaps on his 37 Dodge.
Music. Number 7.
Well, this reminds me of a very happy time in my life when I was in New York hanging about with a lot of underground filmmakers, mainly a guy called Amos Poe, who I made a film with this year in New York, who's a sort of unsung genius. He was a man who invented the term punk and made the first punk film in New York at CBGB's and Max's Kansas City and all those clubs, so the Ramones and Blondie and all those people used to play in the sort of late 70s. And John Lurie was in the film, played a psychopathic sax player, and I had to chase him through the New York subway system, which of course is a dream come true, and they paid me. And this is Harlem Nocturne.
John Lurie and the Lounge Lizards, Harlem Nocturne. So, the work's pouring in, Robbie. Money is not a problem. You're living in a house that you like, in a part of the world that you love, with a woman of your choice.
Mm-hmm.
It all sounds a bit perfect, really.
It does, doesn't it? Yes, I'm just waiting for one of my legs to fall off, really.
You're a lucky man, are you?
I've been damned lucky, I think, really. Yes, I think I would say that.
But what worries you? What really worries you?
I suppose I worry about dying and things like that, like most people do.
But do you worry about losing your edge?
Yes, it's a constant fear. I have nightmares about that.
Do you?
Yeah, but you can't stay a wild and crazy young guy all your life. And hopefully what happens is that your perception of the world becomes more mature and people, you know, age with you, I suppose that's all.
But you have to retain that element of danger to be good,
sure,
don't you?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, but I mean, the battle doesn't have to be between being unstable and being smug. There's lots in between, I think.
And what would you...
He said, showing off his bright yellow socks.
Well, if you just suddenly, as you came into fashion, went out of fashion,
mm-hmm.
how hard would that hit you?
Very hard indeed, because it would mean I wouldn't work. I mean, I think that's true with everybody. That's why unemployment's such a terrible thing, because are we to be judged by what we've done, as it says in the song? And I think we probably, you know, are.
And on a practical financial level, I mean, are you prepared for that day? Have you got
I'm well covered. Yes, jokes. I'm very careful about them. I'm well pensioned.
I'm glad I didn't say that. You're well. You are genuinely well pensioned.
Yes.
You're quite a neat and tidy person, aren't you?
Not neat and tidy, but the boarding houses in the South Coast are full of people who were famous in the 60s, and I'm not going to be one of those.
Last record.
Last record is the Eurythmics singing "Love Is a Stranger."
Why do you want that?
Well, because on our first date, I turned up in an open car. And it was a red Oldsmobile Cutlass. I don't know if you know them. Rather naughty, late 60s. And it's kind of our song.
There you are. You see, there's always a real reason underneath it.
Yeah.
The Eurythmics singing "Love Is a Stranger" in an open car that takes you far away. Which one of the eight, Robbie, if you could only have one on this island, all alone?
Of the records?
Mm.
Oh, God, I don't know, really. That's terribly hard, isn't it?
Mm.
I suppose, really, I'd have the Proclaimer, because that would remind me of everything I was missing, really.
Like what?
Home. Well, home, obviously, Scotland.
And your book. You've got the Bible and Shakespeare waiting for you.
Well, I don't know. Is the Bible compulsory?
No.
I've never found it an awfully good read myself. Songs of Solomon and one or two of the poems are like that. Generally a very dull book. It's very, very hard to decide. I thought, well, Shakespeare is the, you know, if somebody arrived from outer space and said, what are human beings like? You'd hand them Shakespeare and say, look, read that, mate. Come back in 5 years' time and you'll have got us all. So I thought what I would need to was to remind me of what I was missing, and mostly I would think I'd be missing the cities. I'd be missing the city and smart Alex and dames with red lipstick and motor cars and, you know, life in the city. So I think it would have to be Raymond Chandler.
Which one?
Well, there are so many. There's a great anthology out, actually.
No.
Oh, you rosser.
Name your book.
Lady in the Lake, I think.
Right. Yeah. And your luxury?
My luxury is a fierce battle between a 56 Cadillac and endless supplies of paper and pencils. I think probably I would plump for the pencils and the paper because I could always draw and write, hopefully. Dear diary, I've been here for 17 years. It is another sunny day.
Robbie Coltrane, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.